Short disclaimer. This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldon. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted,
the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat.
Welcome to episode 137 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander.
So I'm drinking whiskey for both of us.
Well, I'm not supposed to drink. You lost.
Oh, I thought that was all about we're drinking when we can drink anytime, but I thought that was all about we had to drink when we meet back together.
Well, I think that now you should have to drink for every podcast.
Shut up.
About season two.
Oh, crap. Really?
Why not?
Okay.
I mean, it only seems fair.
Well,
I feel like I lost.
You won.
I know.
Oh.
But if I'm not drinking with you, I feel like I lost.
Well, this is funny because we'll get into it maybe some point in this episode. We haven't even done our intro yet.
I mean, I think that's a fantastic intro.
Pretty much is. But the funny thing is that, and we'll go with a tiny bit of detail, perhaps lightly in a few minutes. This is our discussion of episode 201, which is the first episode of season two. Yay! I'm so happy to be here. It has been a journey and a freaking half, hasn't it?
Well, it's a journey 3 years in the making.
Well, okay, that's true. I wasn't even thinking that. That's a whole other shenanigan thing topic. What I was thinking was just like getting us here, like rushing through, not rushing, but trying to get that darn read-along done and then going to New York and the premiere, and we haven't even talked about that, but by the time this airs, people will have seen the show, so we can talk a little bit about our experience at the premiere perhaps, although that's already been blogged away many times as well. But yeah, so let's tell people first of all kind of what the situation is right now. We're a little bit estranged, dear listener. I'm on the West Coast, Summer's on the East Coast.
I am, and I'm going to be very disappointed if my iPhone mic has a better audio quality than the expensive audio mics that we have in our quote-unquote studio.
Well, the mic I'm using right now might be more expensive than what you're using right now. Right now I'm using the ATR-2100, so I'm actually using the one that we have for the boom arm.
Well, considering that this earbud microphone came with my phone.
Oh, that microphone?
Oh,
Summer. I thought you brought your little fancy schmancy black thing.
I wouldn't have been able to hear you.
Oh, that's true. You know, actually, you sound pretty good for not.
That's what I'm saying.
Seriously?
I'm just saying, if I have better quality iPhone earbud.
First of all, I'd be upset too. Go Apple. No, you're really crystal clear. Okay, so the bottom line is, We're apart. We're 3,000-ish miles apart, but we made this happen, and I've been kind of fearing it. We knew it was coming, so we said, okay, Ginger's at home. That's the most important thing. Summer, wherever you are, you can Skype in. And so where are you? You're in some...
I am...
The plan was to have her go to the car.
It was, but it's cold.
So I told you it was going to be cold.
I know. And I thought I was going to be able to take it, but I wussed out that, and I just didn't want to sit out. I thought that was kind of skeevy to sit in my car for what may end up being a few hours, considering how much you like to talk.
So
I decided instead, since we walked in and they have this kind of a giant lobby area, and the place where they do the breakfast in the morning is still lit and technically open, I was like, well, I'll just go sit in there in the lobby and have this conversation. I can't have it in the hotel room because there are people sleeping there, because I am 3 hours ahead of Ginger.
That's true. You want to tell them, okay, right now, there's no shame in us. I don't care about the time. It is 8:48 p.m. Friday, April 8th. Well, it's the same day. No, not even the same. Well,
it's
only
for
a few more minutes it is.
For like
it
12 more minutes.
Exactly. So it's 11:48 p.m. where Summer is on the East Coast, of course.
It
so
is.
We're, this is interesting, but we've definitely, you and I have recorded separately or recorded apart.
Yeah, I did one from Utah.
That's true. Have we ever done one apart where you're home?
No.
That's the scary thing, because that actually might happen the next few weeks, huh? Actually, no. Next week, I think we're going to bust our butts and get it done before a certain thing happens. And then the following week, we have no way around it.
We'll figure it out.
So yeah, be patient with us.
Wait, aren't you going to be recording it anyway because you have all the recording software?
Well, I think, yeah.
So you're always going to be the one recording.
Perhaps. I mean, yeah, no, you're right. It'll be on the little tablet I'm bringing, which I'm working on still. But yeah, I need to, and I made a list, but I need to get that software transferred or downloaded. Okay, so we've said who we are. I hope you know who we are. We've said where we are and kind of an interesting situation. In case, I'm just going to put it out there. In case you hear a clink clink, it's the whiskey I'm now, according to Summer, apparently forced to drink. Oh, darn, huh? Forced to drink every episode discussion of season two. You're welcome. Number two, if you hear like this boom or rattling of doors, it's because in order to keep things sane, I've locked, quote unquote, I just closed the door. I didn't lock anybody out, but I put the cats out into the rest of the house and I locked my office or shut the office door. One of the cats, Couscous, the small one, actually like jumped or even light kind of hard, tapped hard against the door. And it sounded like the doors were going to come bursting down because they're kind of rickety. And so when they move, like the whole thing moves. So it scared the crap out of me. Okay. So you might hear stuff about cats. You might hear like clinky clinky of my ice if it doesn't melt pretty soon. And Summer's in a public spot. So you might hear people in the background. And look, we're going to go with it because this is what we got to do. Okay. So season two, episode one. Oh my gosh, Summer, I can't believe we're here. Do we want to briefly talk about, not the show yet, but talk about maybe in a few minutes or a few sentences what our experience was like at the premiere? Because we haven't talked about that yet.
Well, I mean, the only thing that I could say about the premiere is that it was, from my experience, it was mostly me meeting a bunch of people I've been talking to online for a very long time.
That is the joke.
That was the culmination of, and, you know, we did get to see the episode. But, I mean, that was the majority of what it was for me, because we didn't get anywhere near Pressline. We didn't get anywhere near Sam and Katrina. We saw them from afar. So, I mean, it was that in and of itself. I mean, it was not much to say as far as that was concerned, but it was an awesome event. I got to meet a bunch of people that I've only talked to online before. So that was a giant bonus. And, you know, when we got to see the first episode, so it was a good night.
So yeah, that's pretty much it. Summer finally got to meet Janet Katsuon. Thank goodness. So she can stop holding that over me.
Wow.
I mean, no, she still may. And, but both of us got to meet Claire McKay. I was like, she's just awesome possum. Oh my gosh. And who else?
Don't know who Claire McKay is, Claire McKay is the herbalist.
Sorry. You know, just
herbalist.
Just name drop here. Who else did we see, Sam?
We saw Peggy from the Ron and Terry show.
Oh, that's right. We saw her in line and we took some pictures. Obviously, Sarah from TV News, but dude, Sarah's like our hotel buddy now. So
Mike, we can't get away from Sarah. She's practically
course,
a third sister.
I know. And of course, there was our little group of people who sat next to us or near us at the premiere. Of course, there was Mandy, our friend Candida. And I know I'm missing people. I know I am. So forgive me. But it was a lot of fun. And yeah, we had fun in line. We had fun. It was great to see it. Don't get me wrong. And then I did that little mini Periscope. So that was kind of cool. I think I looked at it as like 3 minutes, less than 4 minutes. And in general, how was New York?
New York was New York. It was cold. It was very cold.
Oh my gosh, so cold. Thankfully, Stars let us into that, I guess, the waiting area of the antechamber, I guess you could say, of
that
museum.
That was a double-edged sword because they did move us all inside, but then they crunched us all like animals into...
I'd rather be crunched than wet.
No, I don't disagree with that statement. I'm just stating it was, you know, out of the frying pan into the fire. It was like you're trading one thing for another. And it's not a negative at all. It was just, I think they make the right decision. I'm just stating that once you get inside, they were like, kept telling everyone to move forward, but there was nowhere to go. So that's all I was saying. I think it was the right choice because I didn't want to get any wetter than I already was.
Yeah, we had an interesting time getting there. We were dropped off in front of it, but in the wrong in front.
It was not in the front. We were dropped up in back of it, and we had to walk all the way around a city block. It was legit directly on the other side of the block.
Yeah. So New York was awesome. I didn't get teary. The only thing, I mean, okay, I got a little teary during the show, don't get me wrong, but I didn't get, honestly, other than Outlander, which of course I would hope I'd get a little bit emotional about, was when I found, which was like right next door, who would have known this? I didn't know this. We didn't expect it, at least. When I found, for the first time for me, the theater where Hamilton is, that was like, to me, other than the premiere, that was my highlight of my trip. I just wanted that picture and that's it.
The Richard Rogers Theater.
Oh, yeah. Right next to the hotel.
It was right downstairs. It was literally right downstairs.
Next door. It was like right on the same street. Okay, between, there's a tie between, well, I don't know, Hamilton's quite emotional. There's a tie between finding the Hamilton Theater and then, of course, after, we kind of split up a little bit after the premiere, when Sarah and I and her friend went to the Saks Fifth Avenue, because that was my only night there. I had to go that night if I wanted to get pictures in the dark, which I did. And we went down there, we took the subway, that was an experience. The dude, I got my ticket, and then the little things that you like swipe it, and then you, little thingy moves and you walk through it. I couldn't, like, seven times I swiped it, I swear.
The turnstile?
Yes. I tried like every way to Sunday and it would still go bonk, bonk. I was like, are you kidding me? I was so embarrassed. I looked back and the guy in the little, in behind the glass who watches people, like security, whatever, who was behind it, like the guy who was operator or whatever. Mm-hmm. He's like, turn it around. Oh my gosh. He was pissing himself laughing. Everybody, and Sarah was like, oh my God, I don't know you. Oh my God, I don't know you. It was so stupid. Finally, like after seven times, I got through and I'm like, just take me now. Let's go. Let's just find this thing. But yeah, it's actually fine. It was fun. The subway was fun. And it was bitterly cold. Oh my goodness. It was so cold. That night was difficult because trying to, you know, you have to have your hands out to take a picture. And I was trying to keep my hands out, take a picture, and meanwhile, trying to get like a few views of things. Like, my hands were freezing. Oh, it was so painful, but it was worth it. That was, for such a quick and dirty trip, I had a blinking blast.
I'm not done. Well, I mean, I'm going to drive back through it on my way to JFK.
Oh, but I didn't know that. You guys aren't flying out of Lederhosen. You guys aren't flying out of other places?
No, we rented the car at JFK. So we're going to drop it back off there and then fly back out.
Okay, so that was not really an announcement. That was more of a get us stuff out of our system stuff so we can start. But do we have any announcements? I don't know.
No.
This whole week has been one huge announcement that has been tweeted and Facebooked and shared to Kingdom Come. So I think right now we're good. Outlander, Season 2, Episode 1, Through a Glass Darkly. Now, I don't remember, and I didn't look it up, bad podcast host. Did you remember if that's the title of a section or a paragraph. I have had whiskey or a chapter. We'll let you guys answer that. It's definitely from book two and it's somewhere there, but it's one of those wonderful times when they take something from the actual book and make it a title. I love it. Okay. So that's where it comes from, at least from the book in some capacity.
I think it's the name of a chapter. And I think that, when I watched the little featurette at the end of the episode, I believe that Ron talks about that, about the title.
Okay. So the show opens, the episode opens with a little bit of a voiceover. Claire is at the stones. She's waking up. And what we hear is, quote, I wished I were dead, but I'd made a promise and I had to keep it, even if it meant living a life I no longer wanted, unquote. So she's waking up and she's in Craig Nadun, of course, and she finds a ring without a stone. So like this black flat top. And she looks frantically through the grass and she screams. And these are gut-wrenching screams. Now, I said to Summer like 85 times. Were you sitting next to me at the premiere?
Unfortunately, yes, I was.
Hey, keep that between us. Why are you being so mean? So it must have been you. So I guess, come to think of it, I probably wouldn't have asked, except for you, except for Mandy, I probably would not have asked anyone during the show. I think I bent over and asked you like, what, two or three times? What was that thing? What was that thing?
Yes. Oh my gosh, you wouldn't shut up about it. I'm like, oh my God,
I didn't know
ring.
What it was. It's like a ring, but what? It has no stone. What's wrong with it? And you're like, Ginger, I'll talk about it later. But we can't really say what it is yet, but she finds that ring with no stone, and I can't
well,
say...
Even, hey, even before we get to that, let's discuss the fact that much like season one, they had a cold open with a voiceover.
Yeah, we're going to see more kind of mirroring of season one. There's a few times in this episode, and probably throughout the season, of course, as they do, we'll see more. Gut-wrenching screams, and I wrote, Holy Lord, this season is going to destroy me. Quote, he was gone. They were all gone. The world I left only moments ago was now dust. Unquote. Now, just from that part of the voiceover, you get the fact that she was one moment somewhere with people, and she says he. We know that has to be Jamie. And then one moment here. And we don't know quite yet where here is. We find out very soon. We know where here is. We don't know where when is yet. So I just wrote little things like beautiful cinematography, absolutely gorgeous. And the next shot is Claire walking down the road alone in her garb, of course, that we've come to know her in from the end of season, most of season one, actually. And a car comes up behind her and honks. And he's basically trying to figure out, is she okay? And she asks this gentleman what year it is. And he says, it's 1948.
What I loved about this shot here was, like, she had her, like, WTF face when the car honked. She was like, she had that look on her face, like, what the F is going on right now? And then it also made me laugh because I was thinking to myself, what that man must think of her.
This ragamuffin walking down the middle of the street.
In, like, 18th century garb.
Yeah.
Wanting to know what year it is.
And then she goes straight into who won the Battle of Culloden. Who
exactly.
won? I mean, that's random. I mean, not for her, but it is. Just take that before he even answers it. Although, because that's almost, that part almost doesn't matter. What matters more is what she's asking. So the voiceover has told us that one moment she was there with him and one moment she was here, wherever that here is. And so she's gone. So that tells you that there's some kind of travel or movement or change that was literally moment to moment. Okay. So you can read into that what you will. And then she's asking this guy what year it is. So she needs clarification. She finds out it's 1948. And she goes straight into the Battle of Culloden. So knowing, if I'm not mistaken, from the end of season one, what she had told Jamie, right? And what they had wanted to try to do, what their intention was. Now we have this, as you said, this cold open for episode one. And she's not with Jamie. She seems to be nowhere near Jamie. We find out it's 1948. It's not even in the same century as Jamie. And her first, besides the year, her first concern is who won the battle. And she finds out that it's the British. And then the guy says, the British, Cumberland and the British. And at this, as if 1948 weren't enough, this, she breaks. She sinks to her knees and falls apart. And her soul, I wrote, her soul is broken. She is broken. She is alone. And she knows for certain that Jamie is gone.
Well, yeah. And cue the entire theater crying within like the first 5 minutes.
I didn't cry. I'm such a hard ass, I guess. I don't know. Here's the thing.
No one has ever uttered those words in a description of you before, ever, I promise.
That I'm a hard ass?
Yes.
I'm not a hard ass?
No.
I'm a softy.
Yes.
I'm a crier.
God, yes.
Oh, okay. So I think, and I can't remember enough from our experience from 2 years ago, and that's not even a fair comparison, but at the first episode of the premiere of the first episode of season one, I think what it is, and maybe I'm wrong, but I think what it is knowing the story, but, you know, not knowing the episode. We haven't seen it yet. And being in a room full of people. I, like so many people I've chatted with on Twitter, not so much Facebook, but pretty much Twitter. So many people, especially book readers who have this story in their heart for many years. This is such a sensitive or whatever, an important story to them, or they love it so much that they want to experience it in private on their own. And just like you do, right? When you and I are here at home, we want to watch it separately. Part of it is because we don't want to, you don't want me to bug you, but part of it is so that you can have that first reaction on your own. And if I want to burst out crying, I don't want to do it next to anybody except maybe my cats. So,
well, no, and having seen the first episode with a room full of mostly strangers, I was getting kind of annoyed at the cheering. And
oh, I didn't mind that. That was fun. But
well, no, but the problem with the cheering, and it's the same problem I have when I watch with you with your questions and talking, is that the dialogue is being missed.
Oh, yeah, sure.
So people, the action on the screen doesn't pause because you want to laugh or
that
cheer
is true.
Or clap.
That's annoying. I agree.
So, and it's not a negative statement on anyone. It just clarifies more with me as to why it's so important for me to watch this show by myself.
And I agree. And I think that what was missed, and again, it's no one's fault. We had a blast at the premiere. I would not have changed being there for the world. But one thing that was missed is that first experience of an episode when you're on your own and you can, I still had my internal reactions, but my external reactions were definitely in check. So I got tears in my eyes. I did not cry. I just didn't cry. And so maybe I was a hard ass this one time. I don't know. I'm not ashamed to cry, but I do not want to get.
No, you were concerned about your mascara. I'm well aware.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, I have a thing with mascara. I have to do 87 layers of things. We're talking, okay, wash your face, moisturizer, facial primer, eye primer. Sorry, face primer, eye primer, concealer. In between, everything has to dry, right? Concealer, foundation, and then the eye stuff, and then like very last, the mascara, and then your setting spray. It's a freaking ordeal. It just takes me a long time. I just don't do it enough. I know if I did it more, I'd be better. But anyway, I didn't want it to run down my face, but I was pretty sure it wouldn't because I did everything and it stayed. Yeah, it was a. Mostly it wasn't the eye, it wasn't the mascara. Mostly it was the, I didn't know how I was going to react. So I think I kept almost everything in check. So I didn't have, again, externally, I did not have a true or an authentic reaction. Internally, I totally did. But I was like, oh my gosh, this is awesome. Oh my gosh, they did this. And then I was like, holy crap, I lost the bet. I was so, like with Lonnie, I was so convinced that this is too much of a big thing for them to miss. Oh well.
Well, so that's an important distinction. Something we should mention is that it does differ from the books.
Oh, yes.
So
we can't say how yet because I don't want to spoil.
No, we can't. But I would say that some of the things that went down, I was kind of, it was all in the right, contextually, it all fit.
Absolutely.
Everything fit. But there were a few things where I was like, wow, they gave that away. Wow, they gave that away really early. And even though you knew all of those things because you read all the books and you know what's going down, it was kind of like, wow, I can't believe they gave that away, like, right away.
Well, by doing so much, like, literally, I looked at the time as I was watching. They gave more time to 1948 than they did to the 18th century. So
That's going to change real fast.
Oh, I know that. I'm just saying in this episode, it was more than half, literally. So by putting so much time or spending so much time on the 20th century, you have to fill it, right? You have to fill it. What are you going to fill it with? Well, they didn't really make shiz up. Pretty much everything. And we'll get to it. I'll point it out. And I won't say what the difference is because I can't spoil what may or may not be happening later because we don't know what happens in the end here, how they're going to adapt it. I don't mind pointing out a difference. But I don't want to necessarily say if it has, you know, because we don't know how they're going to change things up. So all we can say is that the show starts differently than the book in a certain fashion. However, it starts similarly to the book in that they have, God bless them all, they have kept the framing story. And
they kept a framing story.
No, they kept the fact that there is, correct, there is a framing story, but it's not identical, and that's how it differs. The way they went about it is slightly different, but the cool thing, except for a few things, which unfortunately we can't point out how they're different necessarily, except for a few key things, which actually one of them kind of tweaked me, and we can't talk about it really because that is going to be functioning in the last episode most likely. But anyway, they kept the framing story, that's what's important, and the stuff that they did, most of it, I would say like 85%, is absolutely possible that could have happened just off the page.
I would like to point out that the beginning framing story was almost verbatim what I described in our last interview.
It is, and that's why you guys won. It was an interview, it was a chat. But yeah, that's why you guys won.
Like, I'm pretty sure if you go back and listen, it was almost verbatim, stumbling down the hill, then in the 40s with Frank. I mean, I was pretty
dead
on.
Very specific. And I think Alistair said pretty much the same thing. He would agree with you. So we have the season. No, one of the things that has also been shared to Kingdom Come, I have not shared my version because I've been a little bit busy with red eyes and getting back to work and sleep deprivation and trying to.
Which creates more red eyes.
Oh, stop it. I know. It's, trying to edit a different episode, getting notes for this episode, recording this episode, all of that stuff, right? Which you guys, I know, it's too
all
much.
All the stuff.
So with all the stuff, I haven't had time. There's a lot of stuff I would have loved to have done, but I haven't had a chance. And I have to prioritize. And those are much lower. But what I will do on this episode, the post that the blog post, whatever, for this episode, it'll have obviously the link to the show. It'll have the download. It'll have links to who the director, as we always did for season one, the director, the IMDb link for the director, the IMDb link for the writer and director. And so we'll have everything we normally do. And because we didn't do it yet, and we'll do them in the future, probably separately. But since we didn't do it this week, it's going to be a massive post. It's going to have everything we normally have for an episode discussion. And it's going to have, get ready, all of the official photos for this episode. So basically, the blog post for this episode is going to have, it's going to be big, but it will also include our recording of Bear McCreary's new opening. And speaking of that, so now we're at the theme. So we have all of that happening before the theme opens, the music plays. And here, my notes here were, after having heard this at the premiere, it is so beautiful. It is similar enough to season one that it's instantly recognizable, but different enough to evoke a change of setting and time. I love all of the additions of France. And that's okay. That's both the audio, the sound, the music, as well as the video I meant. So I love the additions of France, the carriage, the Hôpital des Anges. Now, the scene where that guy is like has that like golden colored or brass like pin that he's about to hammer into someone's leg. Did you catch that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Is it like Monsieur
Foret? Yes. Foret. Uh-huh. Foret. You got it. You got it. Very good. Remember who he was?
Yes.
In the hôpital, what was his function?
He was, wasn't he? No, in the hospital, he was a doctor, but outside of
I don't think he's a doctor. I think he was a bone setter.
Oh, wow.
Something like that, but I think it was a bone. He was a bone person, but yes.
But he used those to numb the leg before he cut it off. Remember?
Yes, but he was not a physician. Oh, and then Raya singing the part of the opening in French. I like the touch. It's a little hard to understand, but I like the touch. And then the snake. I love that they're doing that. Go ahead.
Like literally, the imagery that I remember the most from that is the bone setter.
Yeah.
The giant boobs.
Boobs? And I didn't see any boobs. How do I miss boobs?
How did you miss the cleavage? I mean, there was no nipple. It was just like so much cleavage.
How did I miss the
boobs? It was like, it had to have been the second image in the French section. It was
Claire's,
like,
right? Because Claire's not that big.
No. It was like the carriage, and then it was like
boobs.
Giant, you know, cleavage. And then I remember who I believe is Louis XIV walking in the garden.
Oh, yes. He had that, like, the fleur-de-lis on his little cape thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was, like, red and blue and golden. Yeah, okay. Yeah. I agree. That.
And then the bone-setting thing. But, no, I enjoyed...
It was so
I liked
nice.
The new. I liked it. I liked the moving from the old to the new. And I hope they continue to do that with each season to kind of show the passage of the show and the passage of the story.
I agree.
So, we'll see. But then we get to our title card, which this episode was... Wee Roger sleeping on the couch with an airplane.
It was the, okay, yeah, okay, back to that. Hold on a second. I got a few things to say about that. Okay, it opens literally on the legs of Wee Roger Mack. And, Roger Wakefield. Now, he has a wee airplane in his hand, and I wrote, hint.
Is everything wee?
Oh, girl, sorry, apparently so. I wrote, hint, read A Leaf on the Wind of All Hollows, please, because that airplane is very poignant. So poignant. And also, when he drops the airplane, it falls on a book. And I tried so many times to, like, pause it and look at it. And I can't read the second word. It's My Something Book of Tall Ships. Which is funny because Tall Ship Productions, but it's just funny. Yeah. So this has to be all at the manse, of course, with the Rev. Now, the first scene is Frank barging into what we find out is a hospital. And then, across the screen, the bomb drops. Even though the guy in the car already said it, it is Inverness, 1948. And then I wrote, you and Alistair win.
That's right. Drink, bitch.
I already did, bitch. This, dear listeners, is the Starz adaptation of our beloved DIA Whiplash. They got it. In a way, they got it, but they did just fine. So Frank is looking for his wife. Now, pay attention to the timing, because they started Outlander, I did not get this in... I knew it was wrong, according to the book. I knew it was different. I'm like, they're wrong. Why did they do this? And then I realized they made a change, so they had to change it. So if you pay attention to the timing, in the book, she goes back at Beltane and comes back on April... Well, comes back in April of 1746 for a certain reason. And you probably put two and three together if you look at what she said in her opening and then what the question she asked. You can probably make those things out, but I won't say them. So here, since she left in October, so Halloween, and not Beltane, in the book she was gone for 3 years, almost exactly, just under 3 years. Here, she's not, because it's like a whole 6 months or 5 months that were missed. So it's like just under 2.5 years. So that's why they're saying 2 years. And they kept saying 2 years, and I was like, that's wrong, it's 3 years. And I went, oh, that's right. They changed the timing so that at least they kept the consistency. So I'm glad they followed through. But did you catch that?
I didn't.
Okay.
because I forgot about the last season, them having to do that. But, I mean, she would have to have come home.
Yeah.
At that time.
Yes. So the doctor tells Frank, Frank walks through when he sees the doctor, and the doctor says that she's fine, just dehydrated and has a few cuts and bruises.
Which is a little bit of a change, because in the book she was also malnourished.
Yeah, that's true. Now, did they, well, a change, maybe just an incomplete, but yeah. Did they say, not did they say, I'm not going to give anything away, but I'm going to ask you here, live or recorded, when they showed her in the bed, or at any point, at the stones, on the street, in the bed, did she have anything on her hands?
No.
Okay, so that scares me.
No, I think they're saving it. If it's going to happen, they're not going to give it away right now.
No, they're not going to give it away, but there needs to be like a bandage there is what I'm saying. There's nothing to mark it. So that scares me. I'm not going to say what we can't say, but that scares me. So I'm just putting that on the record here, episode one. Okay, episode 201.
Though, what I will say is, because I know that I had a conversation with Mandy about the malnourishment and the, her not being malnourished, and she was like, her clothes shouldn't have fit. She came back malnourished. And I was like, well, when they cut out the malnourished bit, maybe they did that, so Terry didn't need to make a new coat.
Well, maybe.
Because they would have, if they had to do that bit again, they would have had to have made a whole new set of clothes.
To make them big, yeah.
To make them big. So, I mean, I'm sure that's not the only reason, but it was a convenient bit of
I can see that. And that bugs me less than if they don't do the hand thing. If they don't do the hand thing, I will be pissed off. I'm not going to lie. Okay, so the doctor says she's fine, just dehydrated and a few cuts and bruises. We learn that she was quite emotional. Well, we saw that actually. And the doctor had given her a sedative the day before. He tells Frank she's now much better.
Wait, is that Spanish?
Huh?
The sedative?
What?
Sedative. And then I said, is that Spanish?
I don't get it.
Do you not remember when she gave Angus a sedative?
Oh, I do remember that. Did she say it was Spanish?
He asked if it was Spanish.
Oh, okay.
You're fired.
You don't remember certain things. I don't remember certain things. That's why it takes two of us. So Frank enters the room, and there's a song playing on the radio. It's like Milkman something. I'm sure other listeners...
I don't know what song it was.
I like 40s music, but I'm not a big 40s music aficionado or connoisseur. I don't think that's the right word. I don't know a lot about it, so I'm not going to stumble into that.
I'm not a big fan of somebody coming in my room and turning on music and leaving when I clearly didn't want the music on in the first place.
So he comes in and she does not look up. So she doesn't see who it is. And she says, she asks whoever it came in to turn the music off. She still doesn't look up. And then hearing the traffic, she says, it's so noisy here. So she's not saying it's so noisy. She says, it's so noisy here. Another comparison to wherever there is. And when she sees him, she looks up, she sees Frank. She says, hello, I'm back. And Frank says, and I'm so grateful, which is awesome. Well, and the best thing was, he says, I'm so grateful as he shakes his head. Any person who studies or who has read about body language, if your body language or your head language, whatever, does not reflect or mirror your words, it's an untruth.
What I wrote about that was, she says, I wrote it down, and she goes, oh, Frank, hello, I'm back. And I said, awkward. And I said, I mean, what does one really say under those circumstances? So, I mean, I don't even know what you would say. So, I mean, I guess that's the closest thing. I mean, it worked.
I guess it works.
Thinking that was like the most awkward, like, oh, hi.
Too. Maybe they were more limited back in the 40s. I'm thinking the answer is yes. But when the doctor tells Frank about her condition, he leaves something very important out, which we'll get to later. But I'm wondering if it's just
they probably didn't know. They probably didn't check for it.
They probably they did have to do something with like a rabbit or something. So I don't think they had the easy pee test or blood test they have now. Didn't
they
you
had to do something with a rabbit?
Haven't you seen? What's the show with Glenn Close? She's like this raging woman who has an affair with a guy, and then she like stalks
Fatal Attraction.
Him. Yes, Fatal Attraction. There's something in there with the bunny.
Yeah, you know what? She boils it.
Exactly. But my point is, they used to have to boil a bunny, or maybe not boil. They used to have to use.
No,
they used to have to. Summer, I will research it right now. There used to be a pregnancy
Ginger.
Test that involved killing a rabbit.
Like a legitimate one?
Yes.
Or like a folky time?
No,
one?
Like a real one. Okay, I'm going to type it in right now.
That sounds archaic and probably not the easiest way to check if you're pregnant.
Okay. The rabbit test, the origin of a pregnancy test. The rabbit died, she whispers into the phone. This is from pregnancy.about.com. Around 1927, it was discovered that if you injected the urine of a pregnant woman into a rabbit, there would be corpora hemorrhagica in the ovaries of the rabbit. These bulging masses on the ovaries could not be seen without killing the rabbit to inspect the ovaries. Invariably, every rabbit died, even if the woman wasn't pregnant. The phrase, the rabbit died, or the rabbit test, came to be a euphemism for a positive pregnancy test after the late 1920s and early 1930s.
That's horrific.
I'm telling you, I don't make this stuff up. I just have a really weird
You should never have access to the internet.
Summer, this is from, like, childhood knowledge. This is not internet knowledge. I just looked it up
Ginger,
for the first time ever.
I guarantee you, no one told you as a about bunnies being injected with urine.
No one told me. No, I didn't.
I was there for most
Summer,
of your childhood.
I didn't know the details of that. I just read that. I'm saying I knew that there was something involving a rabbit and how it died and in the pregnancy test of a female human. I'm telling you, I knew that much.
But for the record, that has nothing to do with fatal attraction.
But there was a bunny.
That's not why she boiled the bunny.
Why did she boil the bunny? Was it a pet?
Yes.
Okay, sorry.
Oh, my God.
So do I leave that part in?
All of it.
Okay, so there was no bunny, rabbit, whatever, in... Yeah, so anyway, the point is they didn't have a pregnancy test, we believe. Our doctor friend listener can confirm what I'm saying.
Well, no bunnies were injured in the making of this episode.
That is correct. So Frank gets closer to her, and as he's not being violent at all. He's just approaching her, and she has a flashback to BJR, and she freaks out. And of course, he's like, "Oh, I'm sorry." Poor. I do feel really bad for Frank here. I think everyone does. In creeps a photographer, and he snaps their picture. And this is important, people. We need this photo for later. Now, we see it later, but I mean much later. That's all I'm going to say. So Claire, we find out, is to convalesce at the manse where the Reverend and Roger live. And, of course, Frank will be there as well. Claire asks Frank about Mrs. Graham. And I wrote, someone she can trust. I think she needs someone, because she remembers how she read her hand and her tea leaves, and she knows that she probably will be believed for the most part, most likely, if she has to spill.
Well, now she can go and confirm everything that Mrs. Graham saw in her hand.
Exactly.
And
say, this is your fault, bitch. I'm
pretty sure she never said that. She did say the F word a few times, but
that was pretty funny.
She did not, in fact, call her a bitch.
No, she didn't. Okay, so back or... to the manse. So Claire is, okay, this is something that I'm not going to say what the actual thing in the book was. We can say it at the end of the season. Unfortunately, we have to wait 13 episodes. But this is probably the one thing, and I talked to Mandy about it, this is probably the one thing that tweaked me the most. The one thing. Because this is not just like, oh, it could have happened off page, right? Off book or outside. No, this is a legitimate change. And I can't say what happened in the book. If you've read it, you know. But Claire is researching like crazy. And this is a huge difference. And I'm not saying they can't fix it or they can't make it work. Maybe they thought by having her research like crazy that it would mean more to use as a condition when Frank gives his conditions.
Mm-hmm.
But so I see how they fit it in. But it was a change that bugged me. I'm not going to lie. What did you think about that?
I mean, it was a noticeable change because they very specifically state that she does the opposite in the novel.
Okay, so Frank, we find out, had sent a sample of her clothing in to some research center or to some whatever somewhere. And he gets the results. It is legitimately from the 18th century. And they're interested in it, too. So this is little by little. Frank is kind of piecing things together. And I'm not saying he's like not fallen, because that's not the right term. I'm not saying he's walked into it or swallowed a hook, line, and sinker yet. But he, I think, now starts to have doubt about her.
Well, she hasn't said anything to him.
You're right. So there's no doubt here. Right now, he doesn't know. All he knows is she's gone. Yes. So this is the first piece of evidence that Frank gets that is like, huh, this is
weird.
Really old. It's weird and it's really old clothing. And again, don't forget that Frank is a historian.
before it was clearly an ancestry genealogy thing.
Exactly, because in episode one, or sorry, in season one, he's learning. He's asking questions. Now, granted, his questions are very specific. Stuff you would learn in a history class wouldn't be about one soldier or one person, right? He was definitely, you're right, into genealogy. But of course, then things happen and things change, and this is the root of that. But yeah, so Frank sent the sample of her clothing. He finds out it's legitimately from the 18th century. So that's one thing he learns. Claire has also exhausted the Reverend's collection on the Jacobite Rebellion and Culloden. And he has, Mrs. Graham says, the best collection in Scotland.
Now, the photo. Where else would you find the best collection? I think the best collection should be in Scotland.
I agree. So the photo that had been snapped of her in the hospital shows up in the newspaper. Now, remember this.
But can we talk about how great of a photo that was?
Yeah.
Anyone that caught candidly like that probably would have had a not very nice picture in the paper.
It's a Hollywood production, so I get it. But yeah, definitely, definitely very pretty. And then at this point we have, and it may have happened earlier, I don't think so, but this is the first time I took note of it. We have Frank's theme. Remember the clarinet? Da 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 da. That Mrs. Graham outside with Claire. And then this really loud plane flies over and Claire drops an F-bomb. And Mrs. Graham says there might be war with Russia soon. And so Claire's complaining about the noise, whether it's in the hospital, so the traffic on the street or the traffic in the air. And again, more reaction to her, she's acclimatizing to the 20th century, reacclimatizing to it. And she, after she drops the F-bomb, she's relating to Mrs. Graham how she had told Jamie. She's like, I called him an effing sadist and he didn't know what it meant. So I had to explain it. So Claire's telling her. So we find out from this, right? Up until this point, all we know is Claire's reading. When she starts talking about, I called him this, we realize that, and Mrs. Graham is like not reacting except for with sympathy. We realize, or the viewer realizes very quickly, that homegirl has told Mrs. Graham everything.
No, and what kills me is then Mrs. Graham says, keep it safe and secure. Keep it inside. Don't tell anyone. Basically, like, don't tell anyone because they're all going to think you're crazy.
Exactly. Okay, so but before that part, this is something that I didn't consider. I didn't really react to it. I was more reacting to the fact that I still couldn't believe that they made Claire be the researcher. I was like, what? No way. I couldn't get over that. I mean, I'm kind of over it now. I'm not happy about it, but I'm over it. So I was still focusing on that the first time I saw it at the premiere. And then when they start, she mentions calling Jamie an effing sadist. And then we realize that she's told Mrs. Graham everything. This is not necessarily a change. This is a definite possibility because in the book, we don't see, I think it's fair to say, because that's not a spoiler, in the book, we don't see anything of this period. We don't see anything of these. So it's very fair to say that this is all very plausible. Don't you agree?
Yes, we do know some of the stuff that went down, but all of these conversations
are flashbacks.
Are off page. So
yes,
they're implied sometimes that she mentions them, I think, a little bit, but that's more, I think, in Voyager.
She might, but I don't even know that we find out that she told Mrs. Graham everything.
I don't think that we ever even discuss Mrs. Graham again, other than in just to the fact that she was Fiona's
grandma.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're right. And once they start talking about Jamie, the Jamie and Claire theme comes up, if you hear that. And then I wrote, shiz, dude, this is crushing. Jamie, and because she says this, Jamie is dead. At least Mrs. Graham believes her, I wrote. So she says she needs to know if he did die on that battlefield. And this is what you were saying, Summer, that Mrs. Graham is like, you've got to live what you have now. You've had an extraordinary adventure. Treasure it. Keep it safe and secure. Tucked away. But don't spend the rest of your days chasing a ghost. Not when there's a real flesh and blood living man who loves you still with all his heart. And of course, they flash to Frank. And we get Frank's theme again. Very sad. Later that night, or it could be one night, Frank is on his way to his room, but Claire catches him and invites him into hers and says they need to chat. Well, looking back on it, it's very sad. So Frank's all hopeful. Like, he kind of has a little bit of a smile and he's like, oh my gosh, we're making progress here.
And I thought, if he thought, because he mentions to the Reverend that he hasn't asked her what she's been through. It's just been mostly him and her talking pleasantries. So when she says, you know, hey, why don't you come in here and let's talk for a minute? And I'm thinking, if he thought pleasantries were awkward, wait for the truth talk.
Yeah, no kidding. So Frank goes in and they sit down. And then you see that the camera shows them sitting kind of opposite each other around this little, in this room. And I wrote, even before Frank opens his mouth and says, quote, this reminds me of that night at Mrs. Bear's, sitting by the fire. Even before he said that, it reminded me of the night at Mrs. Bear's in front of the fire. Only this time it seems not quite reversed, but similar yet different situation. So not that anyone was confessing anything the first time, but there was almost like Frank was trying to get her to confess something that she didn't have to confess. Yet here, she's confessing everything and he's not saying, I don't believe you. He's saying, look, I will take this in. It's very hard, but I will take it in. And it's almost like the scenes definitely mirror each other in some way or hearken to each other. But it's like this is almost a fulfillment of that one. So whereas she had never done anything with anyone in the first one, and he was trying to say, look, it's okay if you did. She's like, there's nobody. Here, she's like, look, there's been a whole heck of a lot. And he's not denying. I don't think he's in denial as much as he's like, okay, now that you told me, forget about it, or I accept it, basically. And she is not ready to let it go. She keeps punching him. Emotionally, with you don't understand. You don't understand.
Even before she tells him, he's like, I really don't care about anything else. You're back. And I'm like, hold that thought. Let's wait and see what she has to say. And then before she even begins, she starts the whole thing off with saying, save your questions for the end, please.
That sounds like a professor.
Exactly. You know, which is funny. I have a lot to say. Please save all questions till the end. And given the fact that I know exactly how long this story is.
Oh, gosh.
That's a long time to sit in silence.
She basically gave him Outlander and DIA.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And I know how long it took me to read Outlander. And I know exactly how long it took us
2 years to read two
books. I'm like, so that was a really, either a very abbreviated version or we're just really slow readers.
Yes. So the first time in... That was episode one of season one. The first time in that room that Frank is hearkening back to, there was nothing. There was nothing to say, nothing to confess. But he had come in off the street from outside. He had seen a Highlander outside in the rain, a ghost. And this time it was she who had actually been with a Highlander, the very same ghost, and had to tell him that, yes, this time there actually was someone. Frank says she doesn't have to tell him. All that matters is that she's back. It's almost like he doesn't want to know. And then we see Frank's drinking, which is understandable. Claire insists she knows how it must sound as if she's mad. She says thing after thing, seemingly to put him off. Frank agrees it's a leap of faith, but he's willing to make it. But she still will not accept it. She says, well, she doesn't believe him.
I think that there's several things that I want to say about that. One, I think that Frank is relieved to have a reason for the clothing.
Yeah.
He's like, okay, well, that explains the clothing. So, you know, at least I've tied up that loose end. And then I think that honestly, Claire is upset because she's like, this isn't the reaction I was planning for. This isn't the reaction I was prepared for. And I'm not going to finish until you give me what I want. Like she was so dissatisfied that this conversation wasn't going as she wanted it to. And I don't know. I think she felt so guilty about everything that went down to some degree that it was like self-flagellation. Like she's like, you have to be mad at me. Be mad at me so I feel okay about how I feel right now.
Yeah, you can't accept me because look what I've done.
Right. That and if you go back to the book, I remember, I don't know if that was Voyager or not, but she very specifically came back through prepping to not spend her life with Frank, if I remember correctly. She was trying to push him away with this story. So it was almost like she was trying to get him to not stay with her and he was not taking the bait.
And he says he's willing to make that leap of faith, as I said, and she doesn't believe him. She refers to herself as his ex-wife, and he catches that. I thought, whoa, that was a little bit much.
That's all he heard.
Yeah, of course. And she pushes it into his face again. She says, 2 years, that she's like, I was with this guy for 2 years. And Frank gives us his side. He says, what you don't understand is that what it was like to lose you. His theme comes up and I wrote, oh gosh, this makes it even sadder and more tragic. So we experience his heartbreak a little bit. He wanted to hate her. He wanted to fill the void that she left with hatred for her, with betrayal, but he couldn't. And deep down, he knew she hadn't left of her own volition. And even as far-fetched, this is what you were saying kind of about the clothing too, as far-fetched as her tale is, as unbelievable as it may be, it confirms his beliefs that she did not leave him on purpose.
Mm-hmm. And not willingly.
Exactly. So he can't understand her feelings for Jamie, he says, but he accepts them. But Claire won't stop. She insists. She says, you don't understand. And he says he loves her unconditionally. He harkens back to that conversation they had in Mrs. Baird's B&B. He says, and I told you nothing you say could change that. And then she drops the big bomb. She says she's pregnant. And that's all she says at first. She says she's pregnant. And he freezes. And at first, he has this look of joy on his face. And then you see his face change and he realizes it's not his baby. And he explodes.
Well, I think he explodes not only because it's not his baby, but like abusing him with it. Like she's she spends this whole conversation trying to bait him and trying to make him angry because I think she wants to give him an out and she doesn't understand why he's not taking it. Because I think that she is in this place where she can't ever see herself being as in love with him as she was with Jamie. And that's not fair to him. And to sidle him with not only, you know, a wife who doesn't really love him or could never, you know, she's going to always remember he's going to be in the shadow of a man who she loved more mm-hmm. and chose over him. And now he's going to, you know, also have to be around his baby. She's like, this is just going to be insult to injury. You just need to go. And I think she was trying to do him what she probably thought was a kindness. Mm-hmm. But he was not taking the bait.
And, you know, even if you're not a fan of Frank, as they say, FOF, you know, I can't say I may not be or have been a fan of Frank, but I've never been a Frank hater, I don't think. Some people really, really dislike him, but they have done such a nice job. And Diana has defended him from day one, ever since people started picking on him, right?
She defends BJR.
Oh.
So.
Look, I will defend BJR, but not because of what he does, but because it's Tobias.
No, she defended BJR before he was ever Tobias.
Oh, I understand that, but she didn't defend what he did. She defends him for what he is and what he isn't, actually. Right?
Well, all of those things. But she also, I think, she loves all of her characters, even the bad ones.
Well, because they're all
her. So they're all her creations, and they're all little facets and pieces and parts of her. So she would defend any of them. I'm sure that they all have very rational reasons in her mind as to why they do the things they do. I think it would be fascinating to see or to read a story about BJR written from his point of view in which he is the hero.
You know, okay. Me too. And this... We can't talk about it too much because it's majorly spoilery. There's something that I will not name. It is exactly related to what you just said. It's the closest thing we have so far of BJR in book 8 in Moby. There's a scene that I cried. I blubbered. There were only 2 or 3 times in Moby I blubbered, and that was one. That was one. Because it was like, oh. Anyway, that's it. Frank's world implodes again. For a moment, we see a little BJR coming out. He makes a fist and Claire gives him the same face she gave BJR in episode 1 after she went through the stones. So
she gave him a little chin?
The whole face, but the chin, yes. So here we have from season 1. Claire goes back through the stones unwillingly and is confronted by danger. BJR, who threatens and then attempts to assault her after she lies about who she is to protect herself and Frank at that point. She didn't know. Season 2. She goes to the stones. It appears willingly. It appears willingly on purpose. On purpose, at least. She knew she was going this time. She wasn't convinced that she knew where she would end up, but she knew she was going through at least. And she's again assaulted, almost, by another Randall. This time, she explains herself with the truth, also to protect someone. But that someone... And you could, since you just argued, you know, in a way, maybe to... You know, okay, I just got this. When she goes through, one of the things, besides to protect herself, she doesn't know, I think she wants to protect Frank as well. But here, since what you just said, I'm thinking you could also make an argument for her doing this is, like you said, doing him a kindness, right? Protecting him from having to go through life with someone else's baby, right? So he doesn't feel caught or trapped by her. So you could actually probably argue maybe that by her giving the truth quite violently, in a way, she's also trying to protect him. Now, when I wrote protect someone, I was not thinking about him. I was thinking the person, the whole reason, which we'll find out later. I mean, she came back with a baby, so we know that much. And she says it's Jamie's, so we have to believe her. So for some reason, and we don't know why she came back. All we know is she came back with a baby. But I had a certain thing or person in mind when I said to protect someone. Now, Frank needs to break out his inner BJR. And he does things. But at least he breaks things rather than people.
So that yes, was... cue the destructive tantrum. Which reminded me of Kylo Ren in the Force Awakens. When he goes apeshit on that console thing with his lightsaber-y thing.
I like your technical terms.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Okay, so then later at the manse, post-damage, post-BJR or non-BJR Frank damage, the Reverend says that he needs, meaning Frank, needs to focus on what's important. Important. Wow. Important. So the Reverend and Frank are in the sitting room or in the den, whatever. They're together, and Claire's probably either with Mrs. Graham or in her room, who knows where, or reading somewhere. The Reverend says he needs to focus on what's important, and that is Claire and the baby. They talk about his raising a child that's not his own. And this is a very interesting conversation. We see a little bit of the poignancy of it later on, or the importance of it, or the irony of it when Wee Roger comes in. But the Reverend, you have to point out, although he talks about it a little bit too, the Reverend is a man who is raising someone else's child. Absolutely different circumstances. Absolutely different.
But did you think it was weird that he waited till after his wife went missing to check whether or not he was sterile?
I didn't, not necessarily, because they were apart from the war, so it wasn't really a concern. But, and they weren't together very long after, before she left. So I didn't, yeah, I don't know that it's odd, but it's interesting. The timing is interesting. We learn, as you already said, we learn about Frank's sterility and his heartbreak. At first thinking, when Claire says what she said, his heartbreak in first thinking that it was his child, and he had a flash of happiness. And then we hear again Frank's theme, his beautiful theme, quote, "I thought she meant we were having a child," unquote. The Reverend, this made me laugh, and only book readers would get this. The Reverend brings up Mary and Joseph, and Frank says, "I am not Joseph and she is not Mary."
Well, not even that. Before that, he goes, "Other men have faced the situation," and he goes, "I doubt that very much."
That's true. So, but then he brings up Mary and Joseph, and Frank says, "I am not Joseph and she is not Mary." And I wrote, "The funny thing is, BJR's parents, if you remember, were named Mary and Joseph."
Oh, that is funny.
I love it. Sorry. So enter Wee Roger. This little guy is so freaking adorable. And he doesn't even look like, I mean, he may have grown a little bit, but he looks almost the same.
Well, because not that much time has passed real life.
Like 2 years. Well, yeah. By the time they filmed it last year, probably in May, if it was early on, then maybe a year and a half. So that's not so bad.
Yeah.
He may have been taller, but his face didn't look much different. So that's good. And he says, of course, in an accent, which I will not try to repeat, to make. "Excuse me, may I go outside to play?"
Yeah, that was not the right accent.
I know. I just said that I wasn't going to do
that
it.
That was straight up Oliver. "Please, sir."
I didn't even know I did an accent. That's awful.
Yes, you did.
And then,
you
did. And he's holding his wee airplane. And he calls the Rev father.
And that was not a euphemism.
No, the Rev?
No, he's holding his wee airplane.
Oh, summer. No. And he calls the Rev father. And so we learn the wee boy in the conversation between Frank and the Reverend after Roger leaves to go outside to play. We learn that the camera panned to him after Frank said the F word.
Exactly.
Okay, there you go. So we're back in Claire's room, and Frank has said he wants to pick up where they left off. He wants to be together. She has a long skirt on, I think.
She has the same outfit on she was wearing.
But I did, but they didn't show her like full length that I remember in the sun or with light. But in this time when they're in the room again, it looks like not huge, no. And I may be wishful thinking here. This may be wishful thinking, but I could swear there was the tiniest of bumps. The tiniest of bumps. I mean, it could have been just normal stomach, but it was.
I think you're looking for it.
Okay. Yeah, of course. So then the man and wife and child. That's what Frank says. He says he wants it to be man, wife, and child. He said, we'll start over. He tells her he was offered a post at Harvard that he was going to turn down, but now he thinks it would be a good opportunity for them to start over, get away, and also escape the British press. Now, she freaks out. He says the word flog. He's like, the British press will basically flog the story or something like that, or flog the whole thing. And she freaks out and says that, don't ever use the word flog in my presence again. I thought that was, I mean, I get it. I know what they're referring to, but I really didn't think that was overly effective or necessary. What did you think?
I think what that was just an introduction to, oh, you have conditions? Here's my condition.
I can go with that. I thought it was not necessarily the most effective, because if she saw someone flogged, I could say, whoa, have a reaction. But the word flog, I am sorry.
Well, to be honest, she was flogged.
Yeah.
And knowing the aftermath of Jamie's multiple floggings.
Yeah, but just hearing the word, I don't buy it. I can see it makes
her. I think, honestly, it's just one more thing that reminds her of Jamie.
I don't disagree. But I don't really buy that word makes her freak out that much. It's uncomfortable, but making a condition? That was just weird. Frank then says that he has conditions too. He says they are to raise the child as theirs, with him as the father, as a family, not with a ghost as a father. As long as he is alive, he says, she cannot do any more research, and she must let him go. No more looking for references to him. Now, I think having her do the research allowed him to have that condition.
Correct.
But it wasn't unnecessary. Whatever. It's effective. I get it. I see how it's effective in setting it up for a condition, but I...
Well, it'll be her way of honoring Frank.
That's true.
Yeah. Giving into the condition as opposed to a personal choice to not look back.
Which she never would have done. So she says that Jamie made her promise she'd let him go. And so she says, so I will. And then I accept your conditions. So when they hug, Frank looks so happy and so thankful. She is resigned. It is so sad to watch. And he says to her that she makes him happy. And he says, I hope in time I will make you happy too. And that is, it's just so sad to me. That to me is tragic. Well, Claire hands over her clothing. So then she begins to take Jamie's ring off. And the theater, this is one thing during the premiere that people freaked the freak out over. And even I think, went, what? She begins to take Jamie's ring off. And I understand it was for effect, because Frank tells her, when you're ready. And she'll never be ready, dude, but whatever. So honestly,
I've read all the books. She'll never be ready.
Exactly. Now, also, okay, since they let her keep it, and it was just a stunt, basically, by the writers, or writer, I... honestly, it wasn't done, so I can accept it. But that would have been a blinking mistake.
If they'd done it?
Yeah.
Duh.
Yeah.
They would never.
Well, no,
that would never have worked out.
Well, it didn't work out, but at least she has a ring, though. Okay, so as she packs, she again looks at the ring without the stone. We see that she still has it, and she puts it in her luggage. So it's almost like she's hiding it, right?
Well, she's not ready to give it up, whatever it is.
Yeah, but it's not the ring she's wearing. It's something Frank knows about that ring. He does not know about this ring. She's supposed to give everything up. As far as Frank knows, the only thing she has is her wedding ring, because she gave him her clothing, and that's all she came back with. She did not give him that other ring. So, and thank goodness, because stuff happens. Dun, dun, dun. Or she finds out stuff. Dun, dun, dun. And that's really bad. So as she packs, she again looks at the ring without the stone and puts it in her luggage. And I wrote, this is a huge thing to remember for later, dear listeners. It may not come back in this season, but if there's a season 3, it might be next time. So she sees Frank out the window burning her clothes. And I wrote, was that really necessary? Did they, I mean, I get the effect of it, but was that really necessary?
Yeah, couldn't they have just put it in another suitcase and left it at the
manse.
At the reverend's house?
Yeah.
Because, you know, he clearly didn't throw away the other suitcase full of her clothes.
Exactly. The music here is gorgeous. Bear, you are amazing as always. It's so beautiful and so sad. And then the next scene, they're basically on an airplane to America. I love her outfit.
I called the shot the Titanic shot.
Yeah, totally.
Because it reminded me of when we first see Rose getting out of the car and looking up at the Titanic. It was kind of like that, where she gets out of the airplane and looks up at New York City.
And they land in the U.S. And she reaches her hand down to Frank so he can help her down the steps. And Frank says, one more step. And then with the magic of...
Ron Moore.
With the magic of television, we see who grabs her hand. It turns over. We're finally back in 18th century Paris, and it's Jamie. This is one time. This is the probably, other than a little bit of sheen of tears here and there, and the little screech of, oh my gosh, don't take the ring off. Other than those two things, this, when they showed and they got back to Jamie, if they kept the framing story, which they did in a fashion, I knew we wouldn't start with Jamie, right? I knew that. I didn't expect to. I hope we didn't, because I wanted to keep some fashion of the framing story. Well, we got it. And now that they flash back to Jamie, I was like, I'm not going to lie. I was shocked they spent so long in the 20th century. I think it's awesome. I think it's a really great setup for the rest of the series, rest of the season. But I was like, dang, they're just doing it. I'm like, where's Jamie? So I think that is something that is, I was not expecting that they would have so much screen time without Jamie. So I loved it. I think it was very effective. But when they came back to Jamie in France, even right now, I'm getting a little bit verklempt. I loved it. And the whole theater like erupted in screams and like cheers. That was so emotional seeing him. I was like, oh my gosh, she just left him, but she doesn't left him. And there she is. And oh my gosh, I'm getting teary now. So they disembark in France. And a little more reference to Jamie's seasickness. And she says to him, so I guess the trip to Boston is out of the question. I know. I love it. Very clever, Ron Moore. And then we see Myrta, who goes to get rooms for them. And Myrta is as grumpy as ever.
Now, a difference here between the book and the series is that their trip to France was prearranged before they went. Like, it was, they'd already arranged with Jared before they even showed up. So them doing it this way, it was a little bit of a difference. They were never, they never had to go look for lodging. They pretty much showed up and went straight to Jared's house.
Yeah, no, kind of. What happened in the book is that they went to France for Jamie to heal at the Abbey. And from the Abbey, that's where they made the plans, because Jamie's uncle was the abbot or whoever's in charge there. He was the one who then, I think, made the arrangements with Jared. Myrta goes to get their rooms. And then later that night in their room, Jamie is having trouble. We see he's still healing from his wounds, of course, and he says one of the things he tells Claire is that he still feels Randall's touch on him. So you can tell he is still healing. He is still literally healing and also emotionally healing.
Well, can we talk about the fact that he's just landed in France? He's looking very pained getting onto this bed, and she's immediately like, let's talk about the future. How are we going to do this? And I'm
like, oh my gosh,
he's still broken. Please give him just at least a week.
Except that it's episode one, and they spent 25 or 30 minutes with Frank.
1948. Okay,
exactly.
I got you.
They have to rush these things.
I just felt bad for him that she was just, you know.
He can't really escape. So
no.
So talk of stopping the Jacobite Rebellion ensues, as Summer just alluded to. So Jamie asks about trying to win the war other than stopping it. And Claire tells him what she does know. Bonnie Prince Charlie goes to Scotland, raises an army. They had several victories, but that in April 1746, the Jacobites are wiped out at Culloden, and Highland culture is eradicated, basically. They have to stop it there, she says, in France, before the prince leaves for Scotland. Now, here, Claire basically lays out the plan for their time in Paris. She says, so he's like, how are we going to do it? And she says, basically, we're going to infiltrate the circle, we're going to spy, we're going to disrupt Jacobite plans. Basically, Claire has just told you what the plan of season two is.
And so you don't have to watch it anymore.
Exactly. You're done.
Ta-da! You're done. We'll see you guys next year.
And the guy in episode... this is episode one. And the guy at the first half in the 20th century told her what happened. So we know that the British win. Sorry, dudes. So, and then the scene in the bedroom ends with, what are they going to tell Myrta?
Speaking of Myrta, somebody posted a picture from the Glasgow premiere happened. He was there, and he's totally clean shaven, and it freaked me out.
That would freak me out too. He's good looking.
Like, he is, but it's not normal. It's he different. Needs to have a beard. I like it better with a beard. He just looked weird. There was so much face.
So much face. He's someone, honestly, even more than Sam. After Tobias, I like him.
Good.
So I have my list, just so you know my priorities. Okay, at the docks, again, they tell Murtaugh some, or we find out they have told Murtaugh some of it. Now, the some of it is their plan, but Murtaugh's like, you're not telling me everything. What's going on? What's the why behind all of this? And they promise, in the end, Jamie actually does, promises to tell him more when they can. So I wrote, note to self, go reread The Exile so I can find out exactly when they do tell him. Because we know from The Exile, and they brought it in here, this is not from DIA, this is from The Exile, that Murtaugh knows. Murtaugh finds out about Claire. That's been in some previews. So that's not a spoiler if you've been watching previews. We don't know how or when this happens, evidently, or of course, not in episode one, but he does find out. And if you go read, it is not part of Dragonfly and Amber. It is from The Exile, which is a graphic novel that Diana wrote, which gives things from kind of Jamie's point of view, I think, of the time when, I guess, after
Claire arrives.
Yeah, right after Claire arrives. So obviously it goes, I don't know how far, because Jamie doesn't find out till after the witch trial. So it may have been right after Claire arrives, but it goes through a whole span of time. So I have to reread that. And this is just one example of why it is so important. If you're a reader, if you have not read the books, do not worry about it. This is too much information right now and too much nothing to worry about for you. But if you are a reader of the books and you've read, especially if you've read all the books, please read the bulges, or consider that they're called the bulges. Please read things like The Space Between, The Leaf on the Wind of All Hollows, and The Exile, anything and everything. There are so many little tiny things that can pop up, and that thankfully they're keeping in mind and they're bringing them in, because they're things that happen in the story, but they're not part of the big books. So if you're a reader and you go, oh my gosh, they changed it. Well, actually they didn't. They're incorporating things from these other side, smaller stories that are just from someone else's point of view. That's my preaching right there. We find out 3 weeks later, they're finally meeting with Jared. I wonder what took them 3 weeks.
I don't know. I got the impression they were already there, but whatevs. I don't know.
Well, they were on the docks of wherever they landed.
Because they were still there. It was the same docks.
Oh, you're right. Because they have the whole ship thing. Okay. Yeah. Okay, so 3 weeks later, apparently they're still there. They're meeting with Jared. Jared seems to be suspicious about their reasons for wanting his help, wanting to join the cause. Basically,
well, they use Jared as an exposition tool. So none of this happened on page in the book. Mm-hmm. And it could have happened off screen. And it was something that was had the potential of being something that would have happened. But, you know, it was an exposition tool. He basically said, here's everything you need to know about how the Jacobites are seen in France.
Yes. So Jamie, in order to say, okay, well, I got to do something. I got to convince him to help us so we can do our whole plan thing. Jamie shows him his back with all the scars. And this, of course, convinces Jared that he is a true Jacobite because of what the British did to him. Jared accepts him. Now, Jamie wants to meet Jacobite leaders and learn. He tells Jared's like, how can I help you? And he says he wants to meet Jacobite leaders, learn their plans. He suggests that the Stuarts would appreciate support, perhaps, of a Scottish laird, of the Laird Brochtuach, and also the Fraser clan. Jared asks for help running his wine business while he is gone traveling for business. And in return, he says they can stay at his house. And also, Jamie negotiates 35% of the profits.
Because he was only going to offer him 25, which showed Jared that not only was he a smart man, but he could definitely do the wine business just fine. Bartering for better stuff.
Exactly. And he likes to drink wine. So there you go. So Summer, maybe you should look into that.
I should, but that would be very bad. I would drink all of my profits. So the thing that I pointed out from that scene that I wrote down, I should say I didn't point it out, but I'm going to point it out right now.
Point it out to me, girl.
Is that it seemed that Jamie has learned a few things from his Uncle Dougal, whereas showing his back to Jacobite supporters always works out in his favor.
Oh my goodness.
Gets him what he wants.
That's hilarious. So basically, if you have any scar somewhere, use it, girl. Or dude.
I'll get right on that.
No, don't go get a scar. I'm just saying, if you have a scar. Jamie inspects the ships. What was he doing? It was something I wrote down. Jamie inspects the ship.
They were inspecting.
Jared's ship, right?
I think so.
Okay.
But the lesson to be taken from this is Claire goes on a walk by herself good can ever come from this.
No,
nothing good can ever come from Claire walking off by herself.
Let me get into this again. I want you to repeat that because mine was all afoul. Someday, the next day, one day, who knows how many days later, they're back on the dock. Jamie is, we believe, with Jared because Jared shows up later, so he must be with Jared. He's with Jared inspecting his ship. And Claire, who's experiencing morning sickness and wants the fresh air, even though she says it stinks, it's better than being cooped up, she's walking on the dock alone.
And the lesson learned here is you should never let Claire go off by herself. Nothing good can come from Claire walking by herself.
Hello. There would be no Outlander if Claire had not go walking by herself.
So she wouldn't have been spanked if she hadn't gone walking by herself.
Well, that's true. She wouldn't have gone through the stones. She wouldn't have been spanked. What else? Let's make a little list.
She wouldn't have been taken to the witch trials.
Oh, my gosh. That's three.
Let's see, what else has she done walking by herself? She would not have been captured by the British and put in BJR's hands, which led to the spanking. So I guess that was the same thing. Let's see, some solo walking adventures.
Okay, so this is the first one in season two. So basically, Claire going off.
It's the first episode. Of course, it's the first one.
So the first time in season two, Claire goes off by herself and, shizzle goes down. So she's walking on the dock. She sees a commotion and she sees like this commotion on a boat and then someone's in what do you call those things? The thing you carry a body on? Like a makeshift stretcher.
But before we talk about that real quick, can I just say she talked when she was talking about needing to be outside and being from the close confines of her temporary lodging.
Yeah.
Do you remember the temporary lodging? It was huge. It was huge. There was a huge bedroom. There was a huge open living room area with a giant fireplace. I'm thinking this woman has never actually lived in close quarters. If she'd said from the close quarters of the ship they'd been on for the time that it took them to get from the Abbey to there.
From the non-French Abbey to the France.
Thank you. Exactly. But her actual lodgings that they just showed her at looked massive. Anyway, back to the dock.
So as she's walking, she sees a commotion and there's a body on a makeshift stretcher that's being pulled off a ship and carried away really quickly, let's get out of here kind of thing. And and people were kind of not yelling, but inquisitive and a tiny bit of a commotion. And so she follows,
of course she did.
And I think she thinks, she does not follow because of the commotion, I don't think. I think she
sees the stretcher.
Exactly. So she's like, I got to go help somebody. And so she follows the people carrying the body and in true Claire fashion gets herself and her family in trouble. And thus we are introduced, and we'll go into the details in a moment, but thus we are introduced. The whole reason to have this and include it in episode one, which you kind of have to, is to introduce the main villain of the season.
Not the season. The first arc of the season. He's not the whole season.
I understand that, but he's the new villain. He's the only new person.
We'll say the first villain of the season.
The major villain of France.
The first villain in France. He's just the first of the season. Let's just say the first of the season. The first villain we're introduced to this season.
Whatever it is, he has to be introduced now. Or else you wasted more time. So they did it, and I get it. Okay, so I also wrote, it's Le Comte Saint-Germain, and I wrote, he's a cutie.
I wrote Stanley effing Weber, goddamn.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
Okay, so we learn a few things. It is smallpox, as Claire announces, and she says Le Petit Virole, I think. As they're in that little shed place where the Le Comte enters.
There was nothing little about that. That was a giant warehouse.
Well, a warehouse, that's better. A warehouse, not a shed. Or a huge shed. But it was a warehouse. As Le Comte enters, did you notice that music was much more Baroque sounding, more classical sounding?
I didn't hear anything except my heartbeat.
Well,
pounding in my ears.
Oh. So, beautiful music. And of course, way to go, Bear. Claire is threatened by Le Comte. And Jamie protects her, of course, as always. She confirms that another man, as they bring in another body, another man has died of the same disease the first man had. And because there is an audience, is it the port authority man? There was I'm sure he had a title. I didn't get it. But the guy who's in charge.
He's the master of the port or something
like
that. Yeah.
So I think he's with the port authority because Jamie says this is best to leave to the port authority. So he must be in charge of that. But whoever he is, because there is an audience and others have seen and heard, there is no way that this guy, the Port Authority master dude, can hide that the fact that the men died from this disease. And thus, Le Comte is pretty upset. Claire wants people quarantined. And Jamie says, honey, look, it's best left to the Port Authority. Le Comte's ship and its cargo, we find out, must be burned.
Uh-oh. This whole scene to me turned into like a French telenovela.
Yeah.
Like it was all in French. I mean, it had subtitles, but it was just like,
Lottie.
It was like angry words, angry faces. I'm turning and looking at you. And
not my woman.
Exactly. Yeah. It was just like, it was cracking me up. But yeah, so basically they say that they're going to burn this dude's ship. And he says, but he just kind of throws it out. Like, he didn't even say it, like, in a venomous way. He's like, you'll pay.
Oh, yeah.
One way or another, you're going to pay. I'm going to make you regret this.
He's French. He's French. He's hot. He's legit French. He's legit hot. And he's just, like, as cool as a cucumber. He's like, I don't need to raise my voice. I speak French. Take it. Shabam. Le Comte, okay, I already read that. So I wrote, best get out of Dodge, Claire. So Jamie and Claire and Myrta get out of Dodge.
I know. So they stay on the dock and then make out in front of the burning ship, which I think was like the most tasteless thing they could have done.
The writers or the characters?
The characters.
Yeah, that's a little bit much because the Colts just looks like
they're
watching.
It looks like they're celebrating ship burning.
That's a good point. I didn't.
So if you look at the arc of the season so far for the Comte, I don't think his anger's misplaced.
Of course not.
Because from his point of view, this lady shows up, gets his ship burned, and then stands there and watches all of his profits go down in flames and then makes out with her husband like she's celebrating this fact.
That's true. I'm glad you said that. That's why there are two of us, because I didn't catch that. The reason that Jamie and Claire were there is because you have to have one of our two heroes, right? Hero or heroine there.
Or we wouldn't have seen it. Because,
exactly. Yeah. So if they're there, why not have him make smushy face? So whatever.
I thought it was tasteless. That was tacky, Jamie and Claire.
Jared confirms, as if we didn't know, you've made an enemy today. Here today. Yep. And thus ends episode one of season two. Vive now, Outlander. Yes.
Now in the books, wasn't it also like, oh, you've made an enemy today, but you've also made me very wealthy because he was my main competitor.
That's hilarious. Maybe. I think you're right. It may not be the exact words, but I'm pretty sure that sentiment is in there.
And then I heard the Jamie and Claire theme. I did notice it at the very end. Yeah.
I have to go back and look at that. I mean, listen, all of that. So we've made it.
We did make it.
Wow. So I guess it's time to close out.
God, please.
Okay. Thank you, guys. Oh, I want to say one thing. I've asked a few times. I put this out there on Facebook and on Twitter and on social media in general. We would love to hear from you guys. Let us know what you thought about episode 201, Through a Glass Darkly. Do you agree with some of the things we've said? Mostly we just kind of chat about what happens, but about some of our opinions, some of the things that we liked or didn't like or are guessing at. Do you guys agree? Do you disagree? Do you want to take aim at something? Let us know. You can leave us a voicemail on our website through SpeakPipe. It's a little thing on the right-hand side you'll see, and a message of up to 30 seconds. Or you can call our listener feedback line at 916-604-4777. And what we're going to do is in the episode after this, so when we discuss season two, this is all season two. When we discuss
episode two.
Thank you. I'll get there. This is brand new summer. When we discuss episode two, we will have at the beginning, before we get to episode two, we're going to have a tiny or hopefully maybe big, depending on what the feedback is. We're going to have all the listener feedback voice only. We want to push the voice this time because we want you guys to literally be part of the show. We want to hear from you guys. Tell us we're right. Tell us we're wrong. Tell us you agree with us. Tell us you whatever. Just
tell us we missed something.
Oh, my goodness. Actually, to me, that's almost the most important thing. If you agree with us or like what we said, that's nice. But I want to hear what we missed or what you disagreed with, because we want to hear your ideas, your opinions. And because Summer and I listen to, you know, I hear the music. Sometimes Summer doesn't. Sometimes I didn't. Like she just showed at the end. I may mispronounce something. I may miss some Gaelic. Mandy, if you're listening, point that out, because I know there was some Gaelic in there. So much that I know we probably didn't bring up. And if there's something that's important or even really small, especially, oh my gosh, if it's a difference between the book and the show, and it won't be a major spoiler, let us know. We're going to include all of the feedback in the beginning or toward the beginning of our next episode. So thank you so much for listening. Again, the number is 916-604-4777. We can't wait till our next episode. Okay, Summer, we're done.
All right, I gotta go to bed.
Okay, bye-bye, chica.
Bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
Thank you to our generous audio host, audioboom.com. Our audioboom channel is www.audioboom.com/channel/outlanderpod. Visit our website at www.outlanderpod.com. Follow us on Twitter at @outlanderpod. Find us on Facebook at www.facebook.com/outlanderpod or email us at outlanderpod@gmail.com.